Welcome to Headlines. This is David Levinstein. This week we have a wonderful show. We have Rav Zev Leff, who's the Rav of Moshe Matis Show. He's Rosh Yeshiva there, as well as Rosh Kel. He'll be calling in from Eretz Yisrael. We have Rabbi Daniel Neustadt, who's the Av Beis Din of Detroit. And we will have Rabbi Avram Stone, who's the field supervisor for Kashrus at the OU. He's the chief field supervisor. He's additionally the Rav and Rosh Kel of West Orange, a wonderful group of guests. Before we start, I like to, now and then, we get many letters, emails, etc. And I like to go to, occasionally, to read a number of them, or one of them. This week we had some fabulous letters, but we'll get back to them. One I had from a Rabbi Gideon Fox from Australia, who says he's an avid listener, which really is great because we're in New York, we're speaking to guests all over the globe, and we have listeners in Australia. Now we're going to play a message from a young fellow in England. I don't know where in England, but it's an England area code. And listen to this message, and I'd like to get my audience's wonderful opinion.
Hello. I want to tell you that regarding your halachic conversation about fertilization, I do not hold that it should be played on a line where Bochum are going to be calling up and people are unmarried. Do not know about these things, are going to be calling up and hearing such things because it's highly inappropriate in the Heimish community. Or if it is going to be paid, please warn before that such thing is going to be paid, and they should get parents, the parents should authorize them to listen to it or anything like that. So I do want to complain about that. I hope it's been dealt with. I hope it will be dealt with. Thank you very much.
So here's my feeling about this. Because clearly here on the show we speak about topics, many of which you will never hear in a yeshiva or in a shul. Because most rabbanim are just either don't have the knowledge, a lot of times it's cutting edge science or halach, something that's on the edge. And simple. In the next week or two, we're going to be talking about Amazon Echo. You know, Alexa, can you use it on Shabbos? Turn on the light. So it's just the forward edge of halacha. So we had last, you know, Rabbi Bleich. Well, do we have such a topic or not? And my feeling is, you know, when I was in yeshiva, young bacha, we spent 2 months learning the sugyin ksubis of Pesach Pasuach. Now, how could you teach young boys right after the bar mitzvah, Pesach Pasuach matzasi mukaseitz? I mean, clearly very personal, you know. And the answer is, it's Torah. And when it comes to learning halacha and Torah, look, as young children, we learned the story of Lot. We learned the story and his daughters, incestuous relationship. We learned the story of Yehuda and Tamar, next week's story. We have Potiphar's wife and Yosef. So recently, interestingly, somebody sent me a chumash. This is astonishing. I mean, you talk about something astonishing. Somebody sent me a chumash that the Skveri Yeshiva put out, and it deletes the story of Lot and his daughters. It deletes the story of Yehuda. All these stories are taken out of a printed Chumash, which, I mean, you talk about Chadash Asim and HaTorah. I mean, for 3,500 years, we've been learning the Torah, and now we've become, you know, Baruch Hashem, Achshir Dara, we've become more religious. So we started censoring the Torah. Now, I can understand maybe with children, you don't want to learn these things. I don't disagree with that. I'm not, you know, especially young girls in schools. But to actually take it out of the Chumash, I find that, like, really very interesting. I'd love to hear what our listeners have to say about that. But I could just tell you, I went to the great yeshivas in the world, Mir, you know, etc. And we learned all the sugyas and halacha. Because when it comes to Torah, we know Torah is Matayr. And additionally, if we learn about it in a holy environment, we learn how to deal with it. So I'm very proud of the topics we have here. And I have 3,000 years of our Jewish, you know, history and education to back me up, support our, you know, our position here. But I'd love to hear, as usual, what our listenership would say. So let me go back to the... Before we begin, go to our guests. I would like to say something. I think it's really important. You know, The story of Hanukkah could be one of the most important stories that of all the Yom Tovim that we have taught. You can't rate Yom Tovim, but it's certainly such a relevant, incredible. What is Hanukkah about? It's about the first cultural attack on Judaism. The Greeks, the Hellenists, their worship of beauty, of the Olympiads, of the human body, sculpture, the beauty of nature, first attack. And why is it relevant? Here's the Pew Research Center summer, a survey. Okay, you can go online and see it. 71% intermarriage rate among Jews. Right? Less than one-third of Jews in America say they belong to a synagogue, a shul. Among us, the Orthodox, look at the amount of kids at risk. It's almost, you know, everybody knows somebody. So many children. I don't care which community you are. You're in Muncie, you're Flatbush, you're in Lakewood, Eretz Yisrael. I heard in Eretz Yisrael, some people, Rabbi Horowitz here was on the, said up to a 20% in many communities that there's, you know, shababniks, the kids who fall off. And what is this? We know that in Yiddishkeit, there are two Yom Tovim. There's Purim and Hanukkah. The Rambam puts them together, Hilchos Chanukah Purim, right? And what's the difference between them? Purim is the physical survival of our people, right? The story of Yaakov and Esav. Al-char b'chatechia, will we survive the al-char b'chatechia? That's one threat. And the other threat, which the Beis HaLevi writes about, is the spiritual survival of Israel. Es achi, es Esav, the Beis HaLevi says, I fear both my brother, when he's my brother, and they're both very frightening threats. Like Reb Chaim Berlin writes in the Haggadah, we say Machzer, he says, Sabuni gam svavuni. He says there are two threats to Klal Yisrael. Svavuni is when they encircle you, you're threatened, you're scared, right? Israel among the Arabs is svavuni. There's another threat. It's called sabuni. What does sabuni mean? It's a strange word. Chaim Berlin was a great medagdi. He says sabuni means they made you part of the circle. Here in America, we've been invited. We're going to have an Orthodox Jewish son-in-law and daughter-in-law of the president, and the rest of his children are Jewish. His kids all marry Jews. All his grandchildren are Jewish of the future president, right? The universities were accepted in, were leading scholars, professors, Brookings, the biggest, they're all headed by Jews. So clearly it's sabuni, and that's Hanukkah. Hanukkah is when their culture assaults us and says, kiss lachem al keren hasher, she'en lachem chelik b'lekei Yisrael. The Greeks say, our beauty is greater than yours. We've surpassed you as a culture, as a way of life, as a Weltanschauung, as something to bring your children up. Look how successful and beautiful. What a wonderful day, way of life is beautiful and happy. That's the assault on our children, right? So Hanukkah is really very relevant. And it's not just relevant to our children. Right now, thank goodness, in America, maybe in Israel, they have the issue. They certainly do have the issue of the svavuni, the physical survival of, you know, the 400 million people around them who rue for their destruction. But here in America, in England, in Australia, well, here it's a different issue. It's the spiritual survival, and that's what Hanukkah. Well, what do we do about it? You know, it's true, Shailas Chacham, but what's the tshuva? So I want to present a possibility, a possible answer, and maybe you could opine to it. And here's my possible answer. The story of Yosef always occurs during Hanukkah. And, you know, the Darsha Rishuma say, they give all kinds. I'm not a bigamatria person, but if you want some, Yosef is bigamatria melech Yavan. Yosef is bigamatria anti-Yaches. I'm drawing now from the rich, the chassid, the Darsha Rishuma is here, right? So there is clearly, it's not a coincidence that Hanukkah, cultural wars always occur during the story of Yosef. And when you think of it, Yaakov had two wars going on. It is Yaakov and Esav, and Yosef in Mitzrayim, which is the cultural war. Ervas Haaretz, Yosef, Egypt at that time was the cultural center, the most beautiful people. They were just buried in idolatry, hedonism and znus and sensuality, right? And Yosef survives. So we have Yaakov and Esav, Yosef in Mitzrayim. Very interesting. There's a coincidence. Is it a coincidence? But when you think of it, how do we beat American culture? How do we maintain our families, our spirituality, our sense of self on this onslaught of, you know, news, television, media, Google News, endless, and never before have we been so assaulted by it. Used to be you got a paper in the morning, you would buy a magazine. Here, if you have a smartphone, which I imagine most of our listeners have, you're assaulted by it. How many hours a day? Look at recent researchers. People spend 3 hours a day on the internet. How do we survive that? Maintain our identity and keep our children within the fold? So let me tell you how Yosef did it. Maybe a possibility. We know that the Greeks represent beauty, right? The depictions of the body, all the beautiful statues and sensual, right? They were beauty, the Hellenists and beauty. But Yosef is called beautiful too. Yosef was Mesalfel Basari. Yosef was also, what else do we know him? He says, Banais Tzadais Aleshur, right? Yosef was Yifei Tair Vifat. He was beautiful, like his mother. But Yosef was more than beautiful. Yosef has two dreams. Yosef has a dream of Ma'alma Malumim. I was the most successful, the industrialist, the culturalist, the agriculturist, the scientist, the ecologist. He also has the dream of the stars. So Yosef has dreams of beauty, but it's together with a spiritual wealth. Yosef is not about just having a good time. Yosef is about the family values, the emuna, the connection of this world to something that transcends it. So we have to make, if we want to keep our children, there's a war going on Hanukkah. There's the beauty of the world, the beauty of culture, the beauty of America, the beauty of Hollywood, and there's another beauty. There's the beauty of Yosef. And to beat the other beauty, the beauty of the culture of Hanukkah, there's one way. Our way has to be more beautiful. And you know what that means? That means we have a Shabbos, a Yom Tov. It has to be full of joy. It shouldn't be criticism. It should be happiness. Unhappiness is relegated to the back. You know, parents always have a way. We have to love our children. We have to love our families. We have to banish unhappiness. We have to say, I love life. I love the type of life. It's not Shveretz as I need, it's a Gutz as I need. If we could bring the joy, leave the criticism out, because we do have so many values. We have the most fantastic family values. We're taught Derech Eretz. We'll talk about kindness. We'll talk about the incredible joy that comes from nurturing. If we could make our Yaifi greater than their Yaifi, then we will win. Yosef can Yevit Yavan. The story of Yosef comes by Hanukkah because the beauty of Yosef, of having both dreams, the dreams of the stars as well as the dreams of the agriculture, if you could combine those two and live a really good, beautiful, happy life here, then you can beat Yavan. That's the recipe to beat Yavan. And you know what? That's what Hanukkah Gelt is about. Hanukkah Gelt is about, yes, it's good to light a candle, but remember, and Magen Avraham brings in the beginning of Taf Reish Ayin, it's a minig, that's la'alacha. Make the children happy. Even if it's the child in you, or the child that's your wife, your spouse, your parent, give them Hanukkah guilt. Remember, it's the combination. Our beauty has to be greater than their beauty. We can defeat the child at risk, the real child at risk, the child within us. Afreilucha Hanukkah to everybody. Let's go to the phones. Ev Lef, who's the Rav, Rosh Kol, and Rosh Yeshiva of Moshev Matisyo in Eretz Yisrael. Welcome, Rabbi Lef. Who's the Rav?
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the program with you.
So, Rabbi Lef, before we begin with questions, can you maybe perhaps give us a little introduction, give us a small introduction about Skulis, etc., before we begin the questions?
Okay. I'll tell you a story. I saw an article a few years ago, an interview with the head of the orange growers in Israel, and he revealed at the time that they had spent a tremendous amount of money to develop a genetically engineered new orange. And the interviewer asked a very simple question: what was wrong with the old orange that you had to invest so much money to create a new orange? And he said, people today want things fast and easy. and we had to create an orange that had a very thin skin, so it was fast to peel and no pit, so it was easy to eat. When it comes to oranges, that may be okay, but unfortunately, it spilled over to our life of Torah, and people want things fast and easy. They don't want to put in too much investment, too much time, or too much work, and therefore, schoolers are very, very attractive. Just do something that doesn't involve a tremendous amount of work or investment, and you're guaranteed, according to what people tell you, results. I remember one year before Shavuos, there's a shgula to say the tefillah of the Shaloh HaKodesh, that your children should be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah. And obviously it's a very, very fine segula. But I saw the people in my community were making sure to remind people to say the tefillah as if this was going to guarantee that their children are going to be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah. So I sent out a message that anyone who thinks that saying a tefillah, no matter how great the tefillah is, once a year, will guarantee that your children will be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah, has to have their head examined. It takes a lot of investment and a lot of work to ensure that your children, even that doesn't ensure anything, but at least to put the hishtadlus that your children should be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah. But saying a tefillah once a year is not going to accomplish that, no matter how great the shgula is. Shgulas are like the icing on the cake.
Rabbi Leff, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
But I know you're a Telza Talmud.
Right.
And I heard a story years ago that I think it was Rabbi Leizer Telza. His son was married and they had a baby. So when the baby was around a year old, they sent a letter to Leizer and they said, could our father, our beloved, tell us that his chinuch, his derech in chinuch? So the Telza Rav wrote back a one-line postcard. He said, if you waited for a year, this child you could already write off. Before you have the next one, call me, write me, and I'll tell you what to do.
Right. That really has nothing to do with schoolers. The intention over there was that the foundation of something is extremely important. And if the foundation is flawed or weak, then no matter how strong the building is, it's in danger of falling down. So Telza Rav Shiva meant that that the yesod of chinuch for a child, the story I heard a little bit differently, that the father came just as the child was born. And the Telza Rav Shiva said, you're 9 months late. Because the yesod of the chinuch of a child starts by conception. And if the yesod isn't there, no matter what you build on afterwards, is not going to be as strong as it could be because built on a weak yesod. In any case, we've become a Am Shel Segulos instead of an Am Segula. There's an interesting Me'iri, just to show the difference between depending on other people davening for you or whatever. The Gemara says in Bava Basra that a person who has someone sick in his home, Rachmon Litzlan, should go to a chacham, v'yispalilolav, v'yivakesholav rachamim. So then Muki Yosef learns Kipshuto, you go to a chacham, the chacham will daven for you, says that's why we make a mishaberech and shul on Shabbos, that's when the Talmidei Chacham are in shul, they answer amen to the mishaberech, and you mekayim this. The Me'iri says it means something different. You should go to the chacham, and the chacham will teach you how to daven for the person who is sick. Right? It's not so easy. Somebody do something. You have to invest. You have to do something. If you may not know how to do it, so the chacham will do it for you until you can do it. But the main idea is that a person has to put in a tremendous amount of investment and work. And people today want, like I said, fast and easy. We even teach our children like that. Torah has to be fun. Right? We have, videos for children of how much fun it is to be a mitzvah girl and a mitzvah boy, which is very nice, but it's misleading because a child very quickly learns that Torah is not always fun. You know, he gets to be 3 years old and he wants to have an ice cream cone. And his mother tells him, but you just had a fellatio meal. You have to wait an hour, 3 hours, 6 hours before you can have the ice cream cone. The kid says, yeah, but I thought Torah is fun. This isn't fun. And there's a lot less fun things in Torah than that. Torah needs amelus, and that amelus can be tremendous simcha, but it involves a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous amount of investment. But it is a simcha, because the same Torah that says you have to be an omabat Torah says you have to be over the Hashem b'simcha. Tachas ha-shalom v'adat Hashem b'simcha v'tuv levav. Ramosha Feinstein said, famous Ramosha, why a generation in America was lost to Shabbos, and their parents were moser nefesh for Shabbos. They came to America and didn't work on Shabbos, lost their jobs, didn't have money to put on the food on the table, and their children became mechallel Shabbos. Ramosha said because when they came home Friday night, they used to complain how difficult Shabbos is, and how hard it is to not work on Shabbos. And the children heard this, and they looked at Shabbos as a monster. And Mamela, what's it called, when they got old enough, they gave up this monster. But Ramosha didn't mean that the parents should come home and say, oh, Shabbos is so much fun. It's so much fun to lose your job and to look for another job. Right? It's so exhilarating not to have food on the table. That's not what Ramosha meant. Ramosha meant that they should come home and say, yeah, it's difficult to keep Shabbos, and it's hard to look for a job, and it's hard not to have food on the table. But you know what? Shabbos is so valuable and so important and so sweet that it's worth it. That's the way that a person should look. Schoolers are like the icing on the cake. If you put in the investment, you put in the work, and then you have the schooler to be the icing on the cake, schoolers are fine as long as they have some kind of source that is reliable. But if you don't have any cake and all you have is icing, right, unless you're a little kid, it's very unappetizing.
Oh.
That, I think, is...
Rabbi Laffer, is it fair to sum up to say that the segulas are a little bit, for people who aren't willing to do the work, it's a little bit like a get-rich-quick scheme in business?
For a person who's not willing to put in the work, yes.
Yeah, in other words, it's
usually,
an idea. It's a get-rich-quick scheme.
Right, usually get-rich schemes are schemes, and they don't work.
Right.
Go ahead,
I'm sorry.
No.
What do you believe in things like Chai Ruttel, which today has become like this huge inyan? Chai Ruttel, you see it advertised in all the papers. What's your opinion of it?
Okay, I'm not familiar with the source of it, if it has a legitimate source or not. I'll tell you, see, here in Eretz Yisrael, unfortunately, okay, there's a lot of things like this. I heard once an advertisement that supposedly an Adam Gadol, who I'm sure never said this, it's not shaykh that he ever said it, but people quote Anoshim Gedolim and things they never said. The Chazon Ish said that he's been quoted of saying things that he's never thought of and never said or whatever, and same thing for Moshe. In any case, but it happens here in Eretz Yisrael too, that they were looking for donations for an institution for disabled children. And supposedly this Adam Gadol said that if you donate to this institution, he guarantees that you'll never have a disabled child. Now, that's very good because the Rabban Shalom doesn't guarantee that, right? But it's not shaykh to guarantee such a thing. But that is what is going on. That if you'll give to this Chai Rotel, or you give to this institution, or you give to this, then 30 Gedolim will daven for you, and you'll be guaranteed Yeshua's or whatever. There's no guarantees. That's not what the Torah guaranteed. The Torah guaranteed you'll have a very meaningful life, and you may have to put up with challenges in life. Didn't guarantee that everything is going to be okay the way you think it's okay. Right?
Recently there's been a campaign. It was in all the papers here in America. It's called the 9999 campaign.
Yes.
A tzedakah organization said the following: don't wait another 28 years for Yeshua. Friday, the 9th of Kislev, 577, between 6:44 and 6:53, don't miss opportunity 30 Gedalev Tzadiki Hadar will die on behalf of Kupa Seir. So here's the problem. It's supposed to be once in 28 years,
right?
But they ran the ad 3 years ago.
Right.
That time they ran it once in a 50-year, basing it on Yovel. This time was don't wait another 50 years.
Now
it was 3 years ago. Maybe had the Kfitzes Hazman. Now, in 2013 wasn't the first time they ran it, but they also ran it in 09 and 11, declaring it a once in a 7-year opportunity. So we've had now this once in a Yovel opportunity with Kupata Ir has happened four times since 2009. Right? And the source that they quote is Bris Menucha, some obscure sefer.
Right.
And it doesn't say anything what they say. It says the ninth year of Yovel is an Ace Rutzen, and it says every ninth year and every ninth day is also an Ace Rutzen. So
ninth
my question is, it says every ninth year of Yovel and every ninth month of every year and every ninth day is also. So my question is, when you have tzedakas like Kupata Ir really running false ads, and additionally, they ran ads. They used to have these ads. If you give to us, you're going to get a shidduch. And we've had Anashim Gedalim here on the phone. Rabbi Solomon came out. He said it's outright Geneva.
Right.
You have girls, he said, giving their entire savings, hoping for a shidduch. These organizations, what should our attitude be? Should we say, listen, they're doing good things? Or should we say, listen, if you're doing false advertising, there's something wrong with your credibility. Maybe don't give it to some, organization that's 6,000 miles away writing false ads, but take that money and give it to your son's Rebbe, who probably is living on a pittance. What would the Rav say about this?
Okay, the thing is like this. I'm happy to hear that Rabbi Solomon said what he said. It just, as they have an Adam Godel say that, be brave enough to say it is very heartening to hear. Thing is like this, it's very, very disheartening to hear in the name of Anoshim Gedolim, right, who sign on these things, 30 Gedolim, davening for this thing, how they allow themselves to be used for such a thing. How could a Gadol be quoted that you'll never have a disabled child if you give to this organization? Nothing is that guaranteed or simple in this world. What I've been told is that since the matzav is mamish, a pikuach nefesh matzav here, legabe tzedakah, and people mamish need this money, and these organizations do give tzedakah to people who are really needy. And unfortunately today, this is what attracts people, right? These kind of get-rich Ruchnius-wise gimmicks, and that's the way that people will give. So the Gedolim feel that the in this situation, the end justifies the means. And Lamaisa, the daven, and for sure the davening helps, and anybody who feels that this is the only way he's going to be attracted to give, so better that they should give. Again, in my estimation, and I don't understand, again, I don't understand that the Gedolim are big Balei Chesed and they have very, very open hearts and they can't say no to these people. But in my estimation, in the end, it's a terrible Chilul Hashem because these guarantees are not guarantees and people become disillusioned and I don't think that most of the organizations are not on the up and up. But they're using means to attract people to give that are mamash geneva das. It's preying on people's naivete, and in my estimation, it's a terrible thing. Except I can't be done. These anoshim gedolim, I'm sure they have a cheshbon, and I'm sure the cheshbon is not that they're sure that this is a guarantee, but that this will make people give. It's kedai because the need is a great need. But again, I think that to a certain degree, it's a terrible chilul Hashem, and it's out and out geneivas das.
Now, the very same institution was recently in the news that they have $60 million, 60 million shekel investment in a fund, and the fund lost 15% of its value pretty much over the last few months. I mean, is it also right that these tzedakah funds should be amassing, you know, millions, tens of millions of value and doing investments with them? Like, is that what the people gave the money for?
Not only is not what people gave the money for, but the chora halachically, it's also to do that. You're not allowed to invest tzedakah money because it could be a hefset for aniyim and also won't be available to give when it's needed. It's an often halacha like that. So I don't know how they're allowed to do it altogether under, and who is the one who permitted them to do it.
What would you tell people who are you know, bombarded in the mail with these advertisements, and they're very well done. It has like people crying, etc., and usually somebody putting, you know, Rav Chaim putting his money into a. Where should they be giving their tzedakah? If, you know, tzedakah tatzel mimavis.
Right.
Siyim b'mishpat zipado shaver b'tzedakah. Klal Yisrael more than anybody knows. There was recently an article in a paper that the number one. Most munificent group of people in America are the Jews. Where should they be giving their tzedakah?
Okay, I think that just like in everything, where to give your tzedakah and how much to give to, whatever, is a very individualized thing, and a person has to have a rav, somebody that he goes to ask his shailas and kashrus. He has to ask in Hilchot Tzedakah also, and somebody that he relies on that can research the validity of these tzedakahs, how much money really goes to tzedakah and how much goes to the people who are running these institutions. And I remember I once seminary girls come here to Eretz Yisrael, and they're bombarded by people. They walk through Geula, and they're bombarded by people who want tzedakah from them. And they're not going to take a shekel or two because they can smell an American girl, you know, for miles away. And they throw back the shekel or whatever. They want dollars and a lot of them. So the girl said that every time they go into Geula, they're bombarded. And a lot of them are not rich girls that they can give every single time. So I asked Rav Eliyashiv. And the answer I got back from Rav Eliyashiv was, you're not mechuyev to give tzedakah to somebody who has more money than you. Which means that a lot of these people that are putting out their hands in Geula are not aniyim altogether. But you need to be able to ask somebody who can take that responsibility, who knows the situation or can research it, and give you a psak of where it's anoshim hagunim and where it's not, and where it's aniya yircha and not aniya yircha, and all of the halachas of priorities in tzedakah. There's halachas. How it applies to a person individually based on his means or whatever. And just like a person asks Shilas and Orech Chaim and other sections of Yoredei and Evan Ezra and Choshen Mishpat, this is no less part of the Shulchan Aruch.
Well, I saw Purish that says that one of the reasons why Aniya Yerecha Kaidim is because you know the truth, you know where it's going, and you can actually give your tzedakah dollars with...
Interesting.
Well, Rav Lef, thank you very much for shedding some clarity on this inyan. And we, on behalf of all our listeners, we wish you, you know, a good year.
Amen. Thank you. And I'm honored to be part of the great things that you are doing. Really, I'm very impressed with it.
Thank you very much, Rav Lef.
Bye-bye.
Honor of having with us Harav HaGoyin, Reb Daniel Neustadt. He's the Rosh of the Vad HaRabbanim of Detroit. He's the Baal Mechaba, the author of many Sfarim called the Unei Halacha. He's also the grandson of the Gadol HaDoyer, Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky, and put out the MS LeYankiv, all the Sfarim related to Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky. He is the Rav of Bnei Yisrael in Detroit, and in my eyes, he's the Rav Rashi of Detroit, a great honor. Welcome, Rabbi Neustadt. I think that we want. Is there any... you know, recently, if you go through Jewish publications, you see that there are women in Bnei Brak, I'm sorry, particularly in Yerushalayim, in Mei Sharim, who pours lead in a pot and it makes eyes. I mean, do we believe in these things, or do we say it's Maisik Shafim, it's Kamaisi Eretz Mitzrayim? How would you, as a Rav, tell somebody who says they believe they have an Ayin Hara on them and they want to, while they're in Eretz Yisrael, they want it to go, and I think the lady's name is Mrs. Schmerler, and she's going to pour lead in a pot and make eyeballs. What would you, as a Rav, say?
I'm asked this very often.
Rabbi Neustadt, and with a credit card number after it, of course.
I am asked. I'm asked this pretty often, because this lady does come to Detroit and to Cleveland and to other cities in the Midwest, and people flock to her, and they have to give her the credit card number. I tell people like this. I don't think it's usher. I really don't think it's usher. I think the lady means Moshem Shemaim. She's a frum lady, and the most important part is she uses that money to support her children in learning. So it's a form of panasa for her. I don't think it's usher. I do think it's a waste of time. I don't think we have a source for that I'm familiar with. It's not the Nisayu that we have from our Gedolim and our Rebbeim and our Tzaddikim. And we don't do these things because everything that we do is the Nisayu from our Rebbeim. So I say to a person, if you're suffering in your life and you blame it on Ayin Hara and you think that this will make you feel better, go ahead. Like investing in the lottery. You know, it doesn't work most of the time. Once in a while, you never know. But I don't think it's usher. I just think it's silly. So you ought to do it. There's no special issue against doing silly things.
So it's not usher, but if you think that the person may actually feel better, not unlike, you know, like a placebo, and so there's nothing wrong with it.
Nothing wrong with it, but nothing. I would never push anybody. I would never recommend it. But a person says, look, I have this trouble, and I can't get a shidduch. I can't, you know, people never have tzaris. It's a way to help them. It's a chesed. It's a chesed with the lady. It's a chesed with the people. Sometimes actually something happens, nothing to do with this, and they subscribe it to it. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Now, what about the red bendel? What about the red bendel that people wear? Is it mutter?
Red bendel is interesting. You know, it's interesting you're asking about the red bendel because, look, it's been around for a long time, the red bendel. Happens to be a couple of days ago, I happened to have noticed that in the Torah it says that when Zerach and Peretz were born to Tamar, so then the Yaledis put a red bendel around his arm to show the Zeh Yotzer Rishayna. So why did she do that? Why only red? So I happen to have noticed there's a Pirush of Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Chafni, who's one of the Goyim, so that dates back a long time ago, even before the Rishayna. And he says, Zeh Yotzer Rishayna, Mishum Shehu Simen Hatzala V'Yeshua. That's why she put it on Echut Shani. And he brings a source, because by Rachav, it says that when she hid the Meraglim, so she said, as tikvas chut hashani hazeh tikshuri. So the chut hashani, which is red, has some kind of a symbolism of the well of Yeshua. I have no idea if this is the source, and I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but something which has been around in Klal Yisrael for a long time, it's hard for us just to say it's a right. Stupidity. We don't really find a real source for it, but it's been around. So if somebody wants to do it, again, I don't recommend it. I don't think it's usher. I do, however, think that it's also to carry it in the Rosh Hashanah Deraisa. I don't think it's a tachshit, and I don't think it's a malbush. So on Shabbos, I would recommend not to wear it. But if somebody wants to wear it, you can't last, and you can't totally machavek anything which has been around for a long time. You may have had a good source at one time or another. Who knows?
So the red bendel has been around for a long time, and you have a makayer from Rachav. Whereas the pot and the lead, you say you don't know of a makayer for. So
no,
if somebody
know.
Does feel that they have an, they held like Rav, and they do believe they have an Ayin Hara, what would you tell that person who is, you know, beleaguered and, you know, fatzorit about an Ayin Hara?
I would tell her to be mischazik. First of all, I would tell her to not show off whatever good things that she has in her life. Keep it hidden. Don't write on your license plate that you have 10 children. Don't be showy. Don't make that extra special kiddush that's there just to gouge other people's eyes and to show that you are wealthier and greater than them. Don't do anything which you stand out. Ayin Hara is about standing out. Be discreet, be besech ameich, be a regular person. Nobody should look at you as if you're something special. Don't make people become amazed of you. Because when people become amazed of you and they don't say B'li Ayin Hara and they don't connect your success and wealth to Hashem, you're putting yourself in danger. It's all about...
And what about somebody who feels they already have an Ayin Hara on them? What would you tell them?
Is
there a tefillah? Is there a tefillah? Is there a tzaddik? Like, what would you tell them to do?
Tzedakah. Tzedakah is the one thing that works against the Ein Hara, because then you're using that success, that wealth, and that resources that Hashem gave you for good purpose. And tzedakah doesn't have to be in public. You don't have to be a guest of honor. Just discreetly help people, sit people, poor people, talmid chachamim. Use whatever you have in order to this. And the best advice that I can give people, don't wallow in that. Don't think about that. That's not the real issue. The real issue is your connection to Hashem. Don't blame things. You know, sometimes Ein Hara is sort of like the easy way out. Instead of doing tshuva, instead of learning more and doing tzedakah more and doing what you have to do more, you blame outside sources. Stick to the basics. Stick to the Shulchan Aruch. Do what you have to do and let the Ribbono Shel Olam take care of his end. We just know what we have to do. We don't have to dig into mistaris. It's not our area of our Messiah. It's not what we do.
Well, here's a question from Naomi from Lakewood. I'm a single girl, and I have not been read many shidduchim my entire life. I've been sending money to many of the schoolers in Eretz Yisrael. Am I doing a wise thing, or is it a waste of my money?
You know, tzedakah has a tremendous power. We know that the schosim of tzedakah is important, and she should do so. Measuredly, you know, it's something that's part of what we do. We give tzedakah. She should not overdo it. She should not give more than meiser. She needs to put that money away for mitzvah shem when she gets a shidduch. But she should do somewhat. It should follow all the other halachas of tzedakah. There's a concept of ani yircha kaidvin. There is a concept of eretz yisrael. She needs to ask Kashayla maybe where the best money, where the best way to spend her tzedakah dollars is. But to certainly just fall for these messages that they give you, that they tell you this story, that story, that's not our derech. That's not our messiah from our rebbeim. This is not what we do. We believe in tzedakah, of course. Tzedakah saves people from a lot of things. And you should give tzedakah like the halacha demands, which is basically ma'aser. And going more than that, and putting all your effort into that is just misleading.
I'm going to leave you with
the head of the Vada Rabbanim of Detroit, really, in my eyes, the Rav Arashi of Detroit, giving common sense and really Das Torah on how to deal with Ein Hara. Thank you so much, Rabbi Neustadt. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Avram Stone, he's the senior rabbinic field representative. He's also the Rav of B'nai Torah in West Orange, which also the Rosh Kollel of B'nai Torah in West Orange. Welcome, Rabbi Stone.
Thank you. Hi.
So, Rabbi Stone, could you tell us what is a senior rabbinic field representative? What does it mean in layman's terms? What are your responsibilities?
Oh, well, I guess on a certain level, it's essentially it's a mashgiach who does things that are sometimes a little bit more than a normal mashgiach will do. That means a normal mashgiach will have a certain, with the OU, will have a route. He'll have a certain amount of companies that he visits on a regular basis on different frequencies. A senior rabbinic field representative, I have some companies and a route, but more so I do a lot of reviews. The OU is constantly reviewing the facilities that we certify in order to just make sure that another pair of eyes sees them on a maybe irregular basis, but we'll see things. Someone else will look at everything that's going on. In addition, I work with a lot of our other field representatives just a little bit of helping out. We learn from each other. And then I do a number of initial inspections, which are when the company comes to the OU, they want to become kosher. So I have to go in and make the assessment. And much of what I do is also if there are issues, and issues do come up, that need to be assessed and resolved. So I do a lot of that also. It keeps me busy.
Sorry, so let me ask you a number of questions. We've gotten these from listeners and otherwise. I can't run this. Now, in the same supermarket, would you buy cut fruit?
Cut fruit is a whole different story.
Okay.
Cut fruit is a whole different story. And the reasons for it are really, you need to understand what goes on in the supermarket. It depends on the specific supermarket. In fact, I just had this question two or three weeks ago when I was in Arkansas, in the middle of, they don't consider it nowhere, but in the middle of nowhere, as it were, in a supermarket and looking for some melon. So there was some store-cut melon over there. So first of all, you need to determine whether the melon was cut in the store or whether it was cut someplace else. Generally, we could talk about both. First, we could also talk about how you can tell the difference between the two. But a melon which was cut in the store, in the supermarket itself, so there are various departments. As you walk around the store, so you see there's the appy, there's the butcher, there's the deli, there's the bakery. Each department is a separate department. There are places where they prepare the appy, and there are places where they prepare the fruits and the vegetables. In some stores, the policy is a very strict policy that absolutely nothing else will go into that fruit and vegetable cutting room except for fruits and vegetables. In other stores, it's not necessarily true. In other stores, they'll do salads back there. In other stores, they'll do a chicken salad back there. They'll do something with a dressing. They'll do multiple things in that same room. So it's really a question as to what happens over there. If in the particular store they only do fruits and vegetables specifically in that room, so then your issues will be, number one, first of all, are the fruits and vegetables Eretz Yisrael? So is there an issue of Trumas and Maaseres? That's a possibility. The second question is just going to be then whether the kelim, whether the knives that they used to cut the fruits had any kind of treif on them. Generally, aside from the fact that the cutting is a whole cold process, it wouldn't necessarily be a concern. So if it's cut in the store and the store has a room or a place and that room is dedicated only to fruits and vegetables and not to salads and not to any appy work.
What's wrong with salads? When you say what would be wrong if they did salads there?
Well, salads includes chicken salad, tuna salad, non-kosher salads.
Yeah.
Right? So what you're doing is, again, if it's dedicated only to fruits and vegetables, then I wouldn't be uncomfortable buying from there.
Now let's say it wasn't. Isn't it logical to say that they're going to wash the knives because nobody wants to eat a melon and have a taste from salami?
It's true. At the same time,
you're talking about a store that has any type of quality things. Just common sense. I mean, if somebody picked up a melon and it tasted from shrimp, people would just spit it out and go back and complain, and they don't want that.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of svaras that because when you go into the supermarket and you see what the reality is, there's no hard and fast rules. Especially, just remember, the people that are working in supermarkets are wonderful and fine people. There are also people that are making minimum wage, or the union's getting them a little bit more than minimum wage. Don't really necessarily always last that long in the supermarket. You have some employees that are long term, but most of them are somewhat transient. And to be honest with you, policies and rules don't necessarily mean that much in such an environment. People do what's easiest for them to do. People will do whatever works for them, because at the end of the day, it's not the quality that matters. It's that the product has gotten put out on the shelf when your boss wants it out. It's a very simple question. So, again, if you like to eat svaras, that's fine. Go ahead and eat them. But, svaras go out of the mouth, not in.
Rabbi Stone, I understand. Rabbi Stone, you give hashgacha on bakeries, right?
I have, yes. Yes, we do.
So on a Jewish bakery, what certainty do you have that challah is being taken?
Well, it depends. Is the owner from person or not? The bakery is a very general term. Are you asking whether I give hashgachas bakeries as an independent person, as the OU? Was the OU to make sure that challah is taken?
Yeah. How do they know that on a daily basis?
Okay,
where is the list of products? In other words, my question is like this. When you have a list of products, you're giving a heksha on Entenmann's donuts, right? So you went through the product list that they have, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's done by rote. They always get their oil from the same place. They get their flour from the same place. The recipe is a secret. They never change the recipe, etc. Now you have an issue of challah. Well, challah is a daily procedure. So do you have a mashkiach in each place taking challah, or do you trust the entity, be it a proprietary, owned by a proprietor who's a single individual, owned by a public corporation? What is the OU policy as far as Hafrasha's challah?
Oh, so a lot of the OU and other major Ashkachas have a system for taking challah, which I believe Rebelsky Rebelsky developed, I believe, the system. It has to do with tavel matzahs and items that have been baked already but have not had challah taken from them. We put matzahs in each in the bakery. They are situated above the place where the lisha, where the mixing takes place. They have not had challah taken from them. And every day, the person responsible for the bakery in the OU makes a declaration of Hafrashas challah, which, according to whatever technical halachic requirements there are that Rebelsky determined, is sufficient for Hafrashas challah.
So who does it? I'm saying it's in Idaho. Does the mashkiach? Do you send the mashkiach there daily? Like, how do you ascertain?
No. There doesn't need to be a mashkiach there to do it. The challah is taken. You can take challah from one thing on something else. You don't need to take it from the same dough. So the technicality, you could speak to Rabbi Gersten. He can explain to you the technical aspect halachically of why it works. But the matzahs, we leave matzahs in the factory above the mixer. Those matzahs are tevel l'challah. The challah has not been taken from them, and the challah is taken via an oral declaration of Hafrashas challah by the Rav in the OU office in New York, who's responsible for the bakery.
So he does it every day, like every batch?
Every single day.
So he gets up and he says, I'm being mafresh challah from all my bakeries, from the matzah that I was kaveya near the place of the lisha.
Well, he wasn't kaveyat. The mashgiach was kaveyat. And I'm not sure if he says from all my bakeries or he says each one independently. I'm not sure. I don't do that. I just place the matzahs. I make sure to make the first hafrasha, the first declaration of hafrasha, and I also make sure the matzahs are properly disposed of at the end of the year, because of course challah is toin sreifa, so you have to try and get them burnt.
Okay, so wait. So let me ask you another question. The OU is not makban on challah of Yisrael, I understand, correct?
They give hashgacha to products that are not called Yisrael, correct.
So my question to you is, why not put today, it's so cheap, put cameras at the milking stations and have create so that all your milk is now challah of Yisrael? Use cameras in your facilities to facilitate hashgacha?
No.
Why not? And for example, why do I ask that and why not? I think today it's so cheap to put in a nanny cam. It's maybe a couple hundred bucks, $200, and then it's wireless. That, for example, if we had done that, I remember when they had that terrible story of the butcher in Muncie who was Michael Tarfus to half of Muncie for a 10 or a 15 year period. And, three cameras in the store would have fixed the entire situation. Let me preface it like this. I believe that in a lot of the shilos that the OU has, you could be soimich, but certainly with halacha, with roivs and specs fakers to be matter. And the reason not to is, would you do that? Of course not. You don't want to have to come on to a specs fake if you could avoid it. We're trying to be machmir here. Well, if we're trying to be machmir, why wouldn't putting cameras at the places where you're doing hashgacha, which would now not be the question of mirsis, would actually be there's a mashkiach tmidi in effect there. Why wouldn't the OU do that as a matter of policy to avoid and to bring the level of suffix up to such where it is substantially less?
This is beyond your
pay grade, is that it?
Aside from being beyond my pay grade, I can answer this question. It's a very, very large and expansive question. Number one, we don't do things because we're being machmir. We do them because we're doing them right. There's a difference between chumrah and correct. I can get away with a minimal amount of going to the kitchen and ask who's ever doing the cooking for you. You can buy them the cheap stuff and you can buy them the quality stuff. And they'll say they want the quality ingredients. And you say, why? We can get away with the cheap that doesn't taste as good. You're just being machmir. You're not being machmir. You're doing it right. There's a right way and a wrong way. We do things the right way. Anything that's lechatringa is not chumra. It's lechatringa. That's the way it's supposed to be done. Number one. So I believe the premise is off. This is not chumra. What we do is not chumra. What we do is right. We do it correctly. And we do it responsibly. And that's a very, very difficult thing. Responsible is a very difficult thing to find in this day's world.
Would you buy in a supermarket without a heksher?
What would I buy in a supermarket? I would buy fresh vegetables without a heksher, unless it would be something that potentially comes from Eretz Yisrael, and I wasn't certain as to whether, I changed that. Oranges also potentially come from Eretz Yisrael, but Jaffa oranges are generally much more recognizable. However, green peppers, they can easily come from Israel. Tomatoes, easily from Israel. Carrots, also from Israel. So I'd be careful with that for Trumas and Isras. But other than that...
So if they were unmarked, would you buy them?
If what?
If your vegetables were unmarked, would you buy them in a supermarket?
It depends. I would probably do that. But in the ShopRite, ShopRites are different than Giants.
Because?
The reason is because ShopRite has a major contract with the Israeli agricultural industry. So a lot of their, during certain times of the year, a lot of the fruits and vegetables, a lot of the vegetables, some of the vegetables you'll find in ShopRite will all be from Eretz Yisrael. In which case, you have to take Trumas and Isras.
So,
however, if you go into a Safeway, it's not very likely because Safeway doesn't have the same contract.
Would you buy coffee, salt, sugar, flour, dried beans? Would you buy those in the supermarket?
Yeah. Coffee, ground straight coffee, yeah, I would buy that. Salt, yeah. Sugar, yeah.
Flour,
well, I mean, it was a big amount of flour. It doesn't sound very sanitary to me. You know, unless you have a bag. What do you mean, a bag of store brand?
A bag of flour. Yeah.
A bag of flour without hashgacha. I wouldn't have much of a problem with that.
Would you buy frozen corn without hashgacha?
I think I would.
Frozen vegetables, too, then?
Well, some of them, yeah. Some of them. It depends. It depends. It depends where it's a shiloh bishul akum, right? And whether... where things are, what blanching is, or et cetera.
Well, even if it's bishul akum, you can just continue to cook them, right?
Well, if it's already been a problem of bishul akum, it's a problem. You can't fix what's already broken.
Well, if it's on the fire, you can just mix it, and at that point...
Right, but before they put it in the bag, they blanch it. Blanch it as a pre-cook. If they pre-cook it to a degree that it becomes edible, so at that point, I think it's too late, no? I mean, you would have to ask a rabbi.
If it becomes Michael ben Drusoy, you mix it in. I mean, the Ramah says you could throw a tinder in afterwards.
I understand, but if they cook it to a point where it's edible and then it becomes not edible, we had this shiloh with the rice pudding where the rice became a shiloh bishul akum, then it became inedible again, and then it became edible again. So we, Rabelsky, I believe, says that's a problem bishul akum because at an earlier stage was bishul akum. Interesting. Actually, I went to the baby food factory once and had an issue with the sweet potatoes, baby sweet potatoes. So I asked them at that time, I think George Bush was the president. So I asked them, if President Bush would come to your factory, would you give him your sweet potatoes? And they said, of course we would serve it to him. We're very proud of our sweet potatoes. Said, no, it's not Elo Shulchan Malachim. No, it's not. You wouldn't give it to him. It's like the meal. But then, for a moment I thought, okay, so since they wouldn't feed it to him, since it's all baby food and mush, why should it be a Shalab Bishal Akam? Well, before it became baby food and mush, it was not baby food and mush. It was good cooked sweet potatoes. which would be an issue of Bishlachim. But again, these are halachic questions. If I were able to answer halacha, then I would, they would have me answering halacha.
Well, Rabbi Stone, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay, Kol Tov. Thank you.
Bye-bye.